We're going to talk today. This is really going to be a discussion. I'm going to present a case about boards and culture, and then use it as sort of a launching pad to discuss your experiences with this whole issue about boards and culture and the role of boards. And how do you talk about culture? How do you even have a language to talk about it? And then finally, we talk about compensation. How do you compensate? And then we may talk about sort of the emerging role of what's happening in corporate governance, where compensation committees are becoming compensation and management development committees. So that's the goal. For some of you old enough to remember, how many of you remember Peter Drucker? I mean, there. Okay. I mean, no, there are people who don't know who he was. But Peter Drucker's famous comment about this subject is, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And if any of you have been involved with mergers and acquisitions, you know that's true. You know, everybody's got war stories. Everybody got scars in their behinds of companies that didn't appreciate culture. It looked good on a spreadsheet. Strategically, it made a great deal of sense. And probably the most powerful example that I have had in my career was I was working with the chairman of the board and CEO for one of the world's largest resort companies. And one of their portfolio companies was a hotel chain and resort that competed directly with the Ritz-Carlton. And I remember the CEO telling me, all my buildings are Ritz-Carlton quality. All my rooms are Ritz-Carlton quality. All my staff are dressed like with Ritz-Carlton quality. And I can't get Ritz-Carlton quality. It just is not in our DNA. And there's nothing that I can do. And he was so upset with his inability to change the culture that he swore he would never acquire another company. And as long as he was CEO, he never did again. And to the best of my knowledge, this company still has never acquired another company after that. The great founder of Southwestern Airlines once described it beautifully. He said, you know, anybody can buy an airline. Anybody can buy an IT system. These things become commodities very quickly. But once you get a unique culture, you just can't replicate a unique culture. And that's what Southwestern Airlines tried to do.
What did he attribute his inability to transform the culture?
The CEO?
Yeah.
That it couldn't be done. It just wasn't in his company's DNA to have the obsessive customer focus that the Ritz did. He understood why Ritz was as good as it was. He wanted his brand to be as good as Ritz, but he couldn't do it. And wasn't because he didn't try. And it's not because he did. And it's not like Ritz has a secret. They actually bring people in and train people on the Ritz-Carlton technique. I mean, that's the great thing about culture. It's not, you know, Southwestern Airlines culture is no secret. Anybody who's flown on it knows what makes it different from American Airlines. But you just can't do it. And that's the thing about culture. So it's, anybody else have any experience with that? What's your experience?
Yeah, I mean, not as maybe glamorous as that, but I was running this company, and it was sort of a tired, slow-moving company in an industry that was moving very rapidly against mm-hmm. us. And I think the mechanics by which you get frustrated with a culture change are, you go into the CEO, you know, you've got 8 direct reports, how many you have, you might change. Even if you change 8, let's say you change 5, it takes you a year to do that. Then they kind of look at who's down the line, and you know, they might each change 3, it takes them a year to do that. You know, by the time you're done with the personnel part, you know, you've changed 40% of the middle and upper management, but the 60% and then everybody below is where the culture lives. And so, you know, it's probably a 20-year exercise to change the culture. I was there 8, and I made a small shift.
And you know, and you're getting to an issue that I'm going to be addressing. That in certain companies, when CEOs come in, they expect to stay 5 to 7 to 10 years, and they can take a 5 to 7 to 10 year time horizon. In your world, in the utility world, that's sort of expected. But what happens when you have a situation where a CEO is coming in on a transaction basis, is really got an assignment, and everybody knows the CEO is going to be gone in sometime 2 to 4 years later, he's going to be gone. Who's going to be thinking about culture when the CEO's got an assignment of two to four years? When cultural change takes 5 to 7, sometimes 10 years, and that gets into the role of the board.
So I was actually thinking of it from a different angle, because I was thinking a lot about your comments about the M&A side of things, and what I've seen in a couple occasions where the company had inherently a good culture, they bought other companies, and they took one of that person from that other company into the senior management, because after all, if you do a merger of equals, you should take somebody from the other company in the management, and that person actually poisoned the well. And within a year, the senior team that had been a phenomenal senior team was essentially poisoned by this individual who brought the bad culture in and set the seeds going. So,
it's
fragile.
Again, you know,
culture's fragile.
I don't know if this is an actual statistic, but it's a statistic that everybody in this room has. How many of you have heard that 70% of acquisitions fail to achieve the owner's objectives? I heard that it was actually a study by a CPA firm, but I've actually never seen this study. But it is one of those urban myths that everybody talks about, nods their head, and they believe it's true. I happen to believe it's true. My own experience is it's true that 70% don't work.
So I think it depends, in my mind, what your measuring stick is, because you know the deals that we did 26 in 4 years.
Yeah.
And probably three quarters of them for sure hit all the financial objectives. So if the measuring stick is the financial objectives or adding customers or whatever, that doesn't mean there weren't a lot of culture issues or problems or
absolutely
way or whatever. And we had a team that was just razor focused on integration.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be that way.
You have to be that way. Well, let me tell you a little bit about a case, and this is a case that I'm doing right now. So I don't have a solution. So I'm going to come with you to the solution. We're going to call this organization Albany State University. And it's the capital of New York State. And this is a large university system with a business school, liberal arts school, a divinity school, an education school, government school, and a medical campus and teaching hospitals. The culture of this university is rampant decentralization. The best way to look at this university is to think of it as a feudal community where the deans are the power source and the president is more a symbolic figure. There is a saying, every tub on its own bottom, and which means every school is a separate profit and loss center. If you can compare that radically to Boston University, which is a highly centralized culture, and the deans do not have that much power. The president does. At Albany, it's the deans that have the power. I'll give you a small example, then I'll give you a big example about the culture. Here's a small example. Go to the School of Education and go to the library. There's the Journal of Obscure Research. And the School of Ed subscribes to this at an annual cost of $250 a year. And they put all of the journals on the bookshelf, so it takes this much space in the building. And there may be one person every 2 years that might read one of these journals, right? And you go across the yard to the school, the Kennedy School, and they got the same Journal of Obscure Sciences, taking up the same amount of space. Two other students are using. So that's a small example. Here's a big example of how this works at this institution. I was working with the executive vice president of the university, and there was a scandal that broke in the local paper. And the scandal was that the medical school had acquired large tracts of property in Albany, and it was in the poor area of Albany, and they were going to expand the medical school and the hospital campus. And many of the poor people there were going to be forced out, and nobody knew where they were going to go. So the local papers made a big deal about this. And the executive vice president is telling me, nobody outside the university could possibly believe that the dean of a school could make a decision like this and make the buy decisions, and the president of the university and the CFO of the university are totally ignorant about that. But that's exactly what happened. On the other hand, everybody within the university would understand, yes, that's how it happens. So that gives you kind of a sense about the culture. So that's the big picture. Now we go to one of my clients, which is a hospital, which is a Albany State teaching hospital. And this every tub in its own bottom then translates to every physician is the center of the universe. You've got these world-class surgeons and world-class physicians, and many of them are world-class researchers with their own budgets. So they're like little P&L, they're like little entrepreneurs. And the world revolves around them. The problem is that Obamacare is coming. And the hospital is beginning to grasp the implications of Obamacare. And one of the implications, hi, please have a seat. One of the implications of the changes in healthcare is hospitals like Albany can no longer afford to define themselves as, we are a research and teaching institution, and oh, by the way, we also see patients. That's their present definition. In order to financially stay viable, they have to redefine themselves as, we are first and foremost a patient-centric organization, and oh, by the way, we also do research. That is a complete culture shift. To give you a sense of how dramatic the changes are going to be. I'm just going to give you another example. I'm working with a state's largest pediatric physician group. And I don't know how many of you know pediatricians. Any of you know any pediatricians? Okay. Pediatricians are nice people. And they become pediatricians because they love to see children smile. And if they didn't care, they would become osteopathic. They become oncologists, or they would do what do you call bone surgery?
Orthopedic
surgeons, because there you're going to get much more money. You're making a trade-off. You like to see children smile. Under the new healthcare system, under the way things are today, every time a patient comes in a fee-for-service model, the more we do for you, the more money I'm going to get. Under the new system that is emerging, that is completely revolved around, and that is, I'm going to get a fixed fee for working with X number of patients. And when you walk in the room, you're a cost center to me. So everything that you used to is now 180 degrees. The new model for orthopedic surgery, children's surgery, is exactly going to be what happens at your dental practice today. I don't know about you, when I go to my dentist, who am I spending most of my time with? A dental hygienist. It's the dental hygienist who's cleaning my teeth. It's the dental hygienist who's taking the x-ray. It's the dental hygienist who's checking me out. She then scribbles a few words. My dentist walks in, reads what she wrote, says, "How you doing, Larry? See you next year." How many of you have gone through that? Congratulations. That is children's medicine of the future. It is so upon us that this pediatric, now in this case, the board is taking a very proactive role in changing the culture. And what they have decided to do is they're called a physician practice, and they've amended their bylaws to say, we now accept nurses and physician assistants as full members. That's a big change in the world of physicians. It's a big change. They're now going to be on the board. They're full members. That gives you an idea of the dramatic changes that are going to occur in healthcare. So this hospital is dealing with these dramatic changes. And I'm working with the chairman of the board. Now, one of the issues is they have now sort of changed things and said, we're team-centric. We do team-based healthcare. All their job descriptions say team-focused. Or their job descriptions for board members say you need to be team-centric. The problem is you're dealing with the Albany State culture superimposed on the hospital. And so here's the way the definition of a team player is. I'm recognized as the world's best proctologist. People come to me because I'm the world's best proctologist. Therefore, anything that advances proctology advances the hospital. Therefore, I'm a team player. That's the operational definition. So everybody talks the right game, but nobody's doing anything about it. The chairman is very concerned about that. There are physicians on the board. They don't want to make any changes. The president understands the problems, but he's basically counting down when he can retire and get the hell out of Dodge. And what would you do? That's the situation at the board, and that's the situation at the hospital. What would you do? If you were me and advising the chairman, what would you do? Deathly silence.
Wouldn't you try to, number one, I guess I do several things. I try to rearrange the board, maybe get some new blood in there, some new perspectives. Maybe you have to inject a younger culture into the whole hospital training facility. People that are more in tune with what Obamacare is going to be doing and how it's going to work. I don't think you want to give up the research because it's very important, and maybe you have to like house those guys off, kind of spin out a separate little research division so that they can do what they're doing, because we have the same problem down at Brown University.
Yeah, this is really not a problem of, this is not a specific problem of one hospital.
Oh, yeah.
It's a generic problem that all academic teaching centers are either facing now or they will face over the next 24 to 36 months.
Right. And I guess I knew that the dean or the president, whoever the guy is that's the head of the board, you have to kind of give them a package, have them retire early and get some fresh blood in here. Mm-hmm. I hate to keep going back to the fresh blood thing, particularly since I don't have any myself, but you know. I think that's what you have to do. You gotta shake things up. I mean, well, one of the things that we're doing down in Rhode Island through this Ocean State Angel Group is we're going into the hospitals, and the research centers specifically in the hospitals and in the universities, and we're trying to see what they're working on so that we can pull it out and commercialize it and actually help the hospital or the university make money off the research. Because a lot of times the researchers are busy doing research, and okay, we solved that problem, what's the next one? Well, you got to have somebody that's going, let's take this problem that's been solved and make some money with it.
Right.
So that's one of the things that we're doing. We're going to have to get a team like that in here to kind of re-energize the thing and get people focused.
Let me ask the same question in a slightly different way. There's an old Greek saying. Anybody ever heard of the expression, when a fish rots, it rots from the head? The head is the board. And so if you have some cultural issues, shouldn't you be looking at the board first? I mean, one of the things that I have found fascinating, and this is certainly true in financial services, in my experience, when I am working with the board and observing their culture, and then I go down like two or three levels in the organization and observe the middle management, these people in middle management don't even know who the people are on the board. They've never been in the boardroom, but it's like somehow what's going on in the boardroom was communicated downwards to the middle management. You know, for example, if you have a culture that basically looks at legalities as obstacles to overcome, rather than sort of, you know, what's the right thing to do? What's the ethical thing? Let's look at stakeholders, you know, blah 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 blah. No, instead we says we're going to go through a mindless exercise of check the box, just so we can say we checked the box. Guess what? You go two or three levels down to the middle management, they act the same way. And why wouldn't they? Yeah.
Leverage off my experience in the financial world. Over the variety of firms I've worked for and worked with, I've experienced two basic models. One that I would call the partnership model, and the other is the corporate model. And the partnership model, I think, isn't limited to the financial world, because I think a very interesting example would be Nucor in the steel business with what the guy's name was Ken Iverson, who created that company, and he created an ownership, a partnership environment in the steel industry, and created a business that is the kind of equivalent of Southwest Airlines in the steel industry. So you either operate kind of as a little feudal state with a concentration of power and the kind of the cascading of roles, or very much much more diffuse leadership environment. And I think the problem I'm having, though, interpreting this in the context of the case you're giving, is that I'm sitting here thinking the purpose of a research-based hospital is not the same as the purpose of a community-based hospital.
Right.
And trying to okay, so a community hospital can quickly adapt to what I call the kind of the HMO world, the dentist's office world, and that's fine. Everybody, you know, can be successful in that environment. But if you try to force a round peg into a square hole here with a research university adapting to Obamacare, we're going to destroy one of the greatest sources of intellectual energy and creativity and motivation in this country.
So I'm
sitting here being very resistant. Yeah.
I understand where you're coming from, and it's not like the board hasn't thought about these things, but there are also going to be some budget issues coming out of the federal government where there's going to be less money for research.
Can I expand on
they need a new business model.
Yeah. If I can expand on the context of your dilemma.
Yeah.
Okay. So, first of all, your client is one of a handful of teaching hospitals, all associated with the same university.
Right.
But in fact, they're not wholly owned subsidiaries, and they don't roll up through the organization, right, to the president of the university. They're independent entities.
Mm-hmm.
And of the other similarly named, you know,
yep,
Albany State teaching hospitals, they've been competing for 150 years.
Right.
And they can all see each other, go out the front door, go across the street, next door.
Right.
And so they've been competing for research money. They've been competing for development funds and donors. Because, you know, when someone wants their name on a building for $50 million worth,
they compete.
It's either on this side of the street or the other side of the street. And you don't get any benefit if it's the other side of the street. So that's a healthy,
mm-hmm,
you know, perhaps,
yep,
or unhealthy competition. At the same time, you have the government, so the NIH specifically, saying enough of your research and your research and your research among these hospitals on the same street. If you don't cooperate with each other, right, you're not getting funding. So taking away individual hospital funding,
right,
and are now funding the university, the medical school. And the medical school is now responsible for getting those entities to cooperate, something that culturally they haven't done for 150 years. At the same time, the individual entities, and this is in the context of a client of mine, Boston-based teaching hospital, not affiliated,
mm-hmm,
with your client at all. At the same time, we have sequestration, and the research dollars that are coming out of NIH and similar entities are lower than they used to be, right? And you have all of that imposed on a board that I suspect is used to being on this side of the street, surrounded by their competitors, I don't want to say, by their adversaries.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's precisely it, yep.
So Larry, one of the things that I thought I heard you say about the dilemma that you're trying to deal with is really a cultural change of the board. How did they get the board to think differently and to agree upon a model or some type of model to go forward? Because they all have to be either be on the same page or be changed. I agree right here, change a couple of these people. But they have to be in somewhat sync to go somewhere. And this probably sounds to me like a bunch of them that is, they have their head in the sand. We do it this way, we always do it this way, we're not changing, it works for us, that type of thing. They're not seeing the future. Now, it sounds like the chairman concedes the future is changing,
mm-hmm,
right? A couple times I've seen, particularly with where you're trying to look at disruptions in the way things are doing. So it's kind of, it's not incremental change, it's some kind of disrupting thing. Obviously, the regulations are changing here. When you do scenario planning, you take the kind of the board, and you can do this on a short offsite where the board kind of works on what are the scenarios it can have, and you really look at wide-ranging scenarios that can happen. You know, in the utility field or in the energy field, you look at, okay, what happens if oil prices go to, you know, $200 a barrel versus,
right,
cheap? You know, what happens if environmental regulations go off the chart versus it's easy or those type of things? So you set up almost like the typical 2x2 matrix, and you try to get people to think non-incrementally. Paint a picture that's radical, right? The government's not going to fund you that much money.
Right.
They'll only give you, you know, 30% of what you deserve or whatever. What do you do then? And then you start getting people to think broader. And then ultimately, then they can start thinking out of the box a little bit, and then get them to kind of think. Once you get them out of the box, then you can have a more relevant discussion about, okay, where can we go from there?
Let me ask this as a question to everybody. My client is a client that a few people understand it's on the verge of having to make major culture changes to what historically has worked, that what worked in the past won't work in the future. But there are people that don't want to deal with that. And there are people that are just counting down until they retire. Individually, people talk about the culture issue, but I'm not seeing it addressed as a board topic. What's been your experience? Does that ever get addressed as a board topic? You, Alan?
Actually, culture of the company is always part of the conversations, especially because the people conversations occur more and more at the top. When you're talking about strategy, culture,
kind of, especially if you're trying to do shifts in the strategy and you're trying to do a paradigm shift, you know, you get into conversations about culture, all the issues with risk management, ERM, risk management, a lot of time spent on the culture and is the culture the right kind of, so it comes in as an integral part of a lot of different topics. It isn't necessarily always, today let's talk about culture, but it's always,
it's embedded.
It's embedded into the topic,
okay.
Because at the end of the day, how can you focus on a change in strategy if you don't understand?
Is this unique to Ellen? What about the boards you've been on?
I think, you know, I don't know that it's unique to Ellen, but I think one of the problems is that you're dealing with a university. I'm on the Business Advisory Council for the College of Business Administration at the University of Rhode Island. And I was telling
Mike,
I knew it was an actor, Schumann, that, you know, when I went to URI eons ago, it was the only fully accredited business school in the state of Rhode Island. Fully accredited. Bryant wasn't fully accredited. PC was just developing their program, actually. Now, Bryant and Providence College get all the press because they've got supply chain management programs, right. They've got international business. URI is kind of languishing, for lack of a better term. So we've been having discussions down there about what can we do to spur the College of Business Administration on. And how can we make it more vibrant, more exciting? And, you know, so we're one of the things we're doing is we're changing the advisory council board. I'm a relatively new member, and we're having the same problems probably that you're having to a lesser degree.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be a culture change, and we have to push people either out of the way or push them to kind of change their way of thinking. We've got to, you know, one of the things we're going to do, it's a different situation than you have, but, you know, we've got to get some real PR about the university. There's a lot of stuff going on in the College of Business Administration that we know about, but it isn't in the paper. You read about the other schools in the paper, but you don't read about your own. So that's one of the things we've got to change that culture.
I think I may have something that might help. One of the things that I'm finding in working with boards is there's a lack of a common language to talk about culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a kind of a situation where let's talk about freedom and justice and the American way. and everybody is going to put their hand over their heart and say, I believe in all of those things. And I swear to God, I do. And they do. But the problem is, everybody means a little something different. And so it's important when a board, first of all, I think Ellen's experience is probably unique and typical at the same time. It's unique in the sense that she recognizes they're talking about culture, and it's embedded in the conversation. I think that's unique. And I think one of the reasons they're doing it is because Ellen's on the board. I think it's also, your experience is also typical in that I don't see it boards addressing specifically what kind of culture do we want?
Right.
What kind of culture should we have? What kind of language should we use? So you have things where everybody says, we should be team-centric, absolutely. We should be innovative, right? Absolutely. And everybody goes through this pseudo discussion like we're actually talking about something, but we're not. We're just talking about air. So let me show you. This is a model that I did not develop, but I find it useful because it's simple and it can get a board talking about, okay, where are we today? And where do we need to be over the next 3 to 5 years? And when you're talking about culture change, I think it was you who said, you know, you're talking about 10 years to change a culture. And I think the reason that my CEO at that organization was so ineffective is because his company is a well-known public institution. He's thinking quarter by quarter, year by year, and his idea of long-term is 2 years. And if you're going to change culture, you got to be thinking 5 to 7 years, and he doesn't think that way.
I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges is this is really a tsunami in healthcare. It's radical. A lot of these institutions have loved the fact that they've gotten all this money. They've
yep.
had success. Their people are very comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and this is coming down on them. And they've been aware of it for a long time, but no one has wanted to change because they like to keep things as they are. They like their positions with their grant money and whatever.
It's good to be king.
It's good. It's good. And I think that's part of is from top down is to really get people to understand the impact of all of these things. People read about it in different ways, how it affects their organization.
Right.
But I think that's one of the biggest challenges is to lay it out and say, well, we'll be here in 10 years if this...
It's not incremental.
It's really... major.
Yeah, absolutely.
Contrary to the Eleanor, my narrow experience, and this is with my client, is that they're not at, in their cultural board discussions, the service level. This isn't Ritz-Carlton, how do we get the
right.
desk to treat on a one-on-one basis? Why are we not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And why are we?
Right. right.
They're not at the physician, nurse, practitioner level, saying how do our patients feel? How do we
mm-hmm.
how do we best serve our mission
right.
at the individual bed? But rather they're saying, how do we survive this financial tsunami, right? Maybe we need to acquire more brick and mortar. Maybe we need to do less research, be more community-based, less community-based.
Mm-hmm.
How do we just change? None of that is an indication of how do we change the service model on an individual bed basis. I haven't seen that one at all.
Right, and that
they see the billing right changes coming.
That needs that'll be they'll be forced into that.
Right, I've only seen it in terms of. The emotion's all in the accounting model.
Right. And again, I think boards are comfortable talking about the accounting models because that has sort of clarity to it. This stuff here is very vague, and yet the idea is where are we now and where do we need to be? The purpose of giving you this is for your boards, should there be a discussion about culture? Should there be a discussion about what kind of culture should the company be known for? And are we going to be the role models for the rest of the company? Or do we sort of separate ourselves from the rest of the company and say we're different than the rest of the organization? I don't think you can, but this is a way to have a common language, to have a discussion, rather than, I'll show you something else that we are doing. Again, this is something we're doing right now, so you're free to, oops, going back to my client, Albany State Medical, this gets into So the core issue about what does it mean to be a team player? And again, being team-centric is one of those things, particularly in healthcare, where everybody puts their hand on their hearts and says, absolutely, you've just described me to a T. I can't tell you how many job descriptions I have seen in every industry where it says, must be a team player, right? The problem is the word teams player is defined in a very idiosyncratic way. So my definition of a team player may not be your definition of a team player. So what we're trying to do is to create a common language, a commonly understood concept. What does it mean to be a team player? And secondly, and this is gets where the board comes in, how do you pay for it? Because if you want something, you got to be able to pay for it. Here's a study that I did several years ago, and I've never forgotten it. I was working for one of the world's largest executive compensation consulting firms. We had access to a ton of data about compensation. So I decided to do a little study, and I looked at public companies between, I think, $1 billion and $3 billion, so pretty large technology companies. And then I looked at the number of vice presidents who were women. Now, in certain industries like banking, you know, anybody who's not a teller is a vice president. But when you're looking at high tech, the title vice president really has a lot of meaning, and you don't get that title very easily. So I just counted the number of women VPs per 1,000 employees. So I had a matrix. So I was able to get the top companies that seemed to promote women to VPs. And then I tried to do some correlations about what is correlated with that. And you'll never guess what I found. The correlation is that the board of directors had somewhere between 3 to 5% of the CEO's bonus was based on promotion of women and minorities. It could only be 3 to 5%. It doesn't matter. But if it's in the bonus, if the board says this counts, we're paying for it, since CEOs tend to be wealth, personal wealth generation machines for themselves, they say, okay, if this is the game, this is important to you, I know how to max that. It's about as complicated as that. If you want something, pay for it. If you don't want something, talk about it. And so that gets into the issue about what do boards pay for as opposed to what do they talk about. So what we've tried to do here is a proposal for one of my client boards about what does it mean to be a team player. And we're defining team player in ways that anybody who's ever served in the military immediately understands, and that is to take a hit for the team. To do something for the benefit of the organization that does not advance your interests or your group's interest. I'll tell you, and again, in the academic literature, it's called corporate citizenship. Here's an example of corporate citizenship. You go to the bathroom, and you're washing your hands. How many of you, I'm not going to ask a vote, but how many of you take a paper towel and then wipe off the surface? So you're doing something for the benefit of somebody you will never see. It doesn't benefit you at all. Here in the United States, when you go to the men's room and the ladies' room, you will see a lot of wet because people don't care. I just came back from Finland. I've been to Sweden. That's not how they operate. They're good corporate citizens. They will clean the space. So the definition of citizenship, and that's a small example. Here's a good example. One of my clients is a multi-billion-dollar public company in the medical device space. The strategy of the person I'm dealing with is the president, CEO, chairman of the board, and founder of the company. The company decides they want to go and acquire a number of American medical device companies. And the CEO tells the board that's not his strength. And he thinks it's important that there be a highly visible, very competent person to run that acquisition process. So he will remain as CEO of the company. He's going to move to Switzerland. And he will do what he does well, which is sales and business development. And then they're going to appoint somebody as president of the company to be at the corporate headquarters and drive the acquisition. That's an example of you're taking a hit for the team.
And here's another metaphor that comes out of, I guess, maybe the real estate world, and that is the behavior of people that own their house versus the behavior of people that are renting their house. And take a look at the lawn, you know, take a look at the sidewalk, et cetera, et cetera, and you see very, very distinct patterns. And that's what I was touching on earlier when I spoke about Ken Iverson and Nucor. When he created that company, he wanted to have an ownership model at the plant floor.
Yep.
He was a student of the Japanese quality circles and was very interested in the ability of those companies to adapt and innovate. He wanted that in Nucor. Addressed it two ways. One is what you spoke about before, what do you get paid for? And they had a financial incentive system where it was a very, very flat compensation system by American standards, and everybody participated in the success of the company. Everybody got very low fixed compensation,
right.
Very high variable compensation. And this was, you know, the janitor up to the, you know, the executive suite. The other is, do you own what you're working on? That idea of the quality circle, who can influence how we do our work? You know, is it just supervisory level people, or is it the involvement of everybody? So when everybody owns what's going on, they'll wipe the sink off when they walk out of the bathroom. It's their sink.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I can tell a 10-second story about Ken Iverson.
Please.
I was a consultant at Bain & Company, and I was doing relative cost position study of Iverson versus a big integrated steel company, and I decided to be clever and call at 7 a.m. and find some unsuspecting supervisor and get some information that will help me figure out the cost structure. And Ken picks up. And he goes, I know what you're doing, because we always said we're from Bain & Company. So I know what you're doing, and I have no problem. I'll tell you anything you want to know, because my competition will never try to do what I'm doing. And he just laid it out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you create that culture, you, and you know who's up against you, you may just not care.
Yeah, and which gets at what the founder of Southwest Airlines said. You cannot replicate our culture. You can see what we're doing, but you can't do it.
What he said was, you got me on the phone at 7 a.m. You didn't get my secretary, you got me. You know why? I don't have a secretary.
Right.
And this is 1985, so.
Why don't we stop at this point? Any questions, comments?
All right, when you talk about culture in boards, do you think the boards appreciate the fact that it takes a long time to build a culture or to change it, but it doesn't seem to me takes a long time to destroy it? Or have a culture backlash on you.
I mean, you
could have it go, it's a lot easier for its culture to go south than it is to actually change it or to build it into something positive. But you, just a couple of really bad moves, you can lose a whole large group of people. You can lose the locker room real easily.
Well, my experience is that whoever puts together the board agenda is going to control the board discussion. Because what happens is, you know, typically in these board meetings, things are tightly packed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're going to go according to the agenda.
Right.
And if culture is not in the agenda, it's not going to be discussed. It may be embedded, but I'm not sure people will even pick up on it. Because again, many of the people get into boards are more going to be more financially oriented than having discussions about culture. The other, you know, one of the takeaways is culture is important. Peter Drucker's right. Culture eats strategy for breakfast. Culture is hard to, you know, your guy is right. It's very hard to duplicate culture. It's a competitive tool if you know how to do it. Most boards aren't discussing it. One of the reasons they're not discussing it is it's not on the agenda. It's not being put on the agenda. Second is there's no language to talk about it. And so what I've tried to do with this is to give a language so boards can begin to talk about it. The second issue is if you want certain cultural things, are you going to pay for it? If you're not going to pay for it in terms of the CEO bonus, then you're just talking for the sake of talking. It's got to be part of the compensation system. One of the positive things I'm seeing in some companies is the reconfiguration of what used to be called the compensation committee into something called the compensation, and sometimes it's called management development, sometimes it's called succession planning. But what they're saying is that things like succession planning, management development, are so important, it has to be a board responsibility, not a CEO responsibility. And so that would be the committee where some of these issues ought to be talked about.
So that's actually why I had my hand up a couple minutes ago. So while I'd like to say you're completely wrong, I don't think you're completely wrong, but I think I would moderate it a bit.
Sure.
Is I guess my choice of words, only because, and I'm thinking of all the NACD conversations we've had, which represent hundreds and thousands of companies that I've sat in.
Yep.
And these guys were always having this conversation about, it starts with the conversation about strategy, how do you affect strategy, how do you affect change a strategy, and it leads over into, you know, you've got to change how the company does things, you've got to change the mindset, you've got to change how you get there, and it always, and we end up having the compensation conversation, which is, you know, what's the target, how do you measure it, and how do you compensate? Because if we don't compensate people, much as we may want to say we want to change the strategy from here to here, if we don't make that circle, the change won't happen. Essentially, we're talking about culture. We may not use the word culture, which is why I would only moderate and not disagree with you. But very clearly there are live conversations going on at many, many companies about how do you make changes in the way a company behaves. And people realize that it needs to be tied to compensation.
So the
linkages are being made. They may not be made to the extent they need to be made, but the linkages are starting and they've been going on.
It will shock me to say this, because anybody who knows me will be shocked that I'm saying this, but be careful in compensation, because the currency is not always money. And I don't mean turn it over to the HR guys, right? You take a bullet for your buddy, because if you don't, they'll speak badly of you, right? It's not altruistic in a way.
Yeah, right? You're managing your reputation.
It's the, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
I would like to point out and welcome Mary to the room in a in, in, in